You're listening to The Daily Digestionalist with Matthew Heidmark at RadioArian.com.
Comrades, this is your host of the Daily Traditionalist, Matthew Heimbach, and we're here today on 421, and I hope all of you had a great day yesterday. I think Sven and I had a really good show, and he's back with me because we got a lot of comments from folks about wanting to continue this discussion about the truth of National Socialism versus versus the falsehoods, the false narratives that are put out. And, you know, one of the comments, though, is because, of course, I posted my show yesterday, is that this reactionary was posting on my wall about how, you know, well, capitalism, we need to defend the institution because we need to be able to stand, you know, up for small business and things like that. And that kind of also encouraged me to why we have to be able to increase this dialogue about the truth, because people just don't understand what third positionism, what fascism, what National Socialism actually is, and how it actually encourages small business owners, family-owned businesses, to be successful and is against monopolies. So before I bring Sven in, I wanted to start with a quote from Dr. Joseph Goebbels about the idea of the people's community, because that's at the end of the day, as we were talking about yesterday, the idea that the nation is a community. It is an organic expression. So it's not just a phrase, how it's an actual reality. So the quote says, "The people's community must not be a mere phrase, but a revolutionary achievement following from the radical carrying out the basic life needs of the working class. A ruthless battle against corruption, a war against exploitation, freedom for the workers, the elimination of all economic capitalist influence on nationalist policy. Maintaining a rotten economic system has nothing to do with nationalism, which is an affirmation of the fatherland." So with that, Sven, how are you doing today? And let's talk about the idea of a national community. I want to put a first question to you. Why are there so many nationalists in the modern day that actually defend broken institutions that hurt our people, like capitalism? I've always been confused by that, and I want to know your thoughts.
Well, I think that's probably down to ignorance. I think it's down to a sense of patriotism. So people have pride and patriotism in their country, and they see the big institutions and they don't realize that they're corrupt. So they support them, and they support what the country's done in the past. And I think that gives them a bad name, especially when you get groups that claim to be nationalist, especially in Britain, that claim that the war was a good war and compare our enemies to Hitler and things like that. I don't think that's a positive thing. And I think it is down to ignorance, because when you look at the National Socialist State, everything that they did was positive. It was for the people. And the more you look at it, the more you realize the lies that have been told about it. And when you're talking there about these big monopolies, this is what we see around us today. We see these big supermarkets or malls in America that are just owned by these Jewish interests. And they're out of town. People drive to them. They sell everything. And what they've done is they've done the small shopkeeper out of all his business. And in Britain, we used to be known as a nation of shopkeepers. And now everyone just goes to these big out-of-town stores where you can buy everything. And it's really destroyed the sense of community, because you used to be able to go to the local shop and that's where you would get all your news from. You would pick up on everything that was happening in the community. You would see the people that you'd grown up with there. You would see all the people there. You would bump into in the shop and you'd find out all the news of what's been going on. So it wasn't just a place to go to pick up what you need and get out of there as quickly as possible. It was a place to go and socialize. The post office was the same, and the pub. And they've done away with the pub. They've done away with the post office in the small villages. And they're now doing away with all the shops. And one of the ways they're doing this is by putting double yellow lines outside all these shops. So you can't park. So you can't drive into the town and park outside the shop that you want to go into anymore, because you'll get a ticket, again, which just makes money for the state. And all the money, therefore, goes to these big companies. And we know they're Jews. The head of Tesco's, which is the main one in Britain, he's a Jew. Sainsbury's got Jewish links. All of these big companies, these big stores, it's the same with the big chains that you see with, like Starbucks, Amazon. All these big companies are owned by Jews, and it's basically taken all that money away from the local community, because before you would earn your money and then you would pay it out to somebody locally. They would get that money and then you would get it back because they would be buying something from you, because you would have a little barter economy going in your area where you lived. And this was the sort of thing that National Socialism was trying to encourage. And they prevented these big monopolies. They got rid of these big superstores, and they ensured that it was in the hands of the German people and not in the hands of the foreigners anymore. So rather than what we're told about them being nasty to foreigners and kicking them all out, they actually bought them out of their business interests. They gave them the going price for it as well, and then gave it back to the people that it should have got, that it should have had it in the first place. Because don't forget, these Jews, they took advantage of the crashing of the economy in the Weimar period in order to buy everything up. So they were buying up all these interests.
Essentially, it's the same thing happened in the American South after the war, as we had the term carpetbaggers to, would come down after, the region had been decimated after, the huge number of the population. I mean, some towns, 25-50% of the male population was dead or maimed. The economy was in shambles, and you had these, northern profiteers come down and buy farms and buy businesses and buy everything for pennies on the dollar, as a form of exploitation, and that's what they did. And that's the exact same thing, like you said, that happened in Germany, in the Weimar period. When Germany was on its knees, people didn't nurse it back to health. They kicked it while it was down. You know what I mean?
Well, I think the thing that really hurt was it was the very people that had brought Germany to its knees that were then buying everything up. And you had Jews that were moving in there from the rest of Europe so that they could buy everything up. And it was the Jews in the banking system that had destroyed the country, pretty much, and taken over all the institutions. So there was this righteous anger against the Jews for the way that they were siphoning the money out from the country. And one of the ways that the Germans dealt with this was that they said, well, you can only be a citizen if you're German. So they brought the ethnicity into it, and you had to be ethnically German in order to be a citizen and to be a part of the state. And you also had to pass exams to do that. You had the right to be a citizen, but you still had to pass tests to show you what your duties would be as a citizen, what your rights were and what your duties would be. And they didn't kick out everyone that was foreign. They had them there as guests, but they weren't citizens. They were there as guests. If they misbehaved, then they would be asked to leave. And obviously the Jews had misbehaved, so they were asked to leave. But they were treated very humanely. Far more humanely than we're taught. For instance, if we talk about Kristallnacht, when we're told that there were all these pogroms and all these attacks on these Jews, as soon as Goebbels heard about this, he was furious at what was happening because of how bad it was going to make Germany look. And there's a lot of evidence to show that this was set up by a Jewish organization from France that wanted it to look like the Jews were being persecuted by the Germans. Because at the time, the Jews had just started this boycott up in America, and the German economy was just starting to pick up again. So the last thing they wanted was, on top of this boycott, was to look like they were attacking Jews. So there wasn't this mistreatment of the Jews. They were paid for what they were asked to give back to the state, which included farms, so that the farms could go back to the farmers. And they were paid the going rate. They weren't, like with their paintings, they didn't have all their paintings stolen from them. The national treasures were bought back at the going rate. They were trying to treat them decently. They weren't trying to upset these people, as it were. They were trying to behave honorably, because that's what it was all about, is being honorable.
Well, I mean, exactly. And you hit on a very important thing that, again, the policies can be viewed in two different ways. And, obviously, the Jewish media wants to be able to frame everything in a certain way. And, I mean, it says that old phrase says, the Jew cries out as he strikes you. It's really true when you're talking about the economic boycott, because everyone seems to forget, well, I mean, not us, obviously, but a lot of people seem to forget that the Jews literally declared war on Germany. They said they were going to economically destroy the country, that they were going to drive Germany into the ground, and they were going to use all of their connections in every European country and in America and around the world to be able to wage economic war against Germany. So you can't really get mad. You know, if someone is not only starting the fight but taking the first swing, I find it very difficult for people to then justify why they wouldn't fight back. I mean, any sane individual would. If someone starts swinging on you, you protect yourself, and that's what the Germans were doing. And so on the, on the flip side, when you look at things that the Jews just conveniently out of the history leave that section out. They leave out what was going on. They leave out the exploitation. They leave out the German women that were forced to prostitute themselves just for a piece of bread during the Weimar Republic. As the national treasure was just being looted by these international elites. You know, as Hitler said, that these are the first elements, this international clique that can truly be called international, because they do their business anywhere. They would go to Berlin and take their money, and they'd be in Paris or Brussels the next day, and then they'd be in the United States or, you know, around the world. That they would simply go as parasites to be able to steal wealth and to be able to imprison the people in debt slavery through usury, and mind control through control of the propaganda system of radio and television and things like that. And that's why National Socialism had to, if you're going to fight for the best interests of your people, it isn't just about, you know, biology. And everyone thinks the National Socialists just cared about, you know, the blood. No, they were doing everything from reinvigorating the traditional German form of art, of sculptures, of poetry. They were putting traditional German folk dress back into the consciousness for celebrations. They were, changing where you bought your clothes, what type of clothes you were buying. They changed the education system. They had to change everything, because as the system was set up, just as it is in the United States and the West now, it is set up to enslave you in debt, to break apart your family, to break apart your ethnic ties, to break your ties with your ancestors and the traditional culture, and to create an entirely artificial existence. So if you're going to have a national revival, if you're going to have the people's community that Dr. Goebbels was speaking of, you need to be able to, it's not just a remodel. You have to tear the house down to the foundation and rebuild it, because this system is purposely built to be crippling towards the best interests and the longevity of our folk.
Well, yes, it wasn't, they said that it wasn't for export either, because it was all about Germany and about the German people, and looking back into German history and teaching the youth about their glorious German history. And what they meant by it wasn't for export was that they didn't want to force everybody else to become German, but these ideas that they had were natural ideas. It was following the natural order, and other countries could take them up and take on these ideas. And just to go back to the Jews and the treaty of the Jews, we're told that they had to wear these yellow stars as if this was a terrible thing, but they had to wear the yellow stars for their protection. If they were wearing the yellow star, then if trouble was started, then the police would know that one of them was a Jew and that he should protect the Jew. Strangely enough, that was what those yellow stars were for. It was for their own protection. After the way they had behaved, and after Kristallnacht, people were righteously angry against the Jews. So they would wear these stars, and if trouble did start, then the police would know that one of them was a Jew, and it could possibly be that somebody was picking on him. So, you see, things were a completely different way around to what we are taught. And the ones that were really subversive were put into these retraining camps where they were put to work. And this wasn't a new idea. This was done by England in the Middle Ages. They tried putting the Jews on farms so that they could teach them how to farm and teach them how to do constructive things instead of engaging in usury. And it was found that they just weren't capable of it. They just weren't able to do it. It seems that all the Jew is capable of doing, really, is usury and preying on the nation that he lives among. So, of course, people aren't going to be happy with that when they have this group of people that are living among them that are just corrupting their own people and parasiting off the wealth from them. So they're going to react to it. And that's what National Socialism was. It was a reaction to that. And it wasn't a violent reaction to it. It was a well thought out, decent and honorable reaction to it, which is why they've had to lie about it and cover it up today with this story about the gas chambers, because they really don't want you looking into this and realizing that actually these Germans were really good people. I mean, the Germans are still really good people today. Look at, you know, just look at how badly they feel about foreigners when really they should be looking out for their own interests.
Well, yeah, I mean, and when I was in Germany, you know, I got to be able to see that the German spirit, you know, is battered, but it's not broken. And that everyone, you know, nationalist or non-nationalist that I met, just really, except for the Antifa, of course, who were screaming and throwing bottles and all those sorts of things, but they're a separate category. But the German is just a kind, accommodating person and always has been. And I think you're right. I was actually reading an article in the Daily Caller today about how the UK should get away from National Holocaust Remembrance Day, because it unfairly discriminates, oddly enough, against other genocides, you know, and different indigenous groups from around the world, that they want to be able to hold their remembrance ceremonies. And of course, we know that the Anti-Defamation League, if you've ever seen the video of the ADL leadership a few years ago in Ukraine, I think it was Ukraine, saying that you know, they can't remember the Holodomor, where millions of Ukrainians were you know, ethnically purged, because that would take away from the Holocaust. And you know how they've petitioned against the United States Congress that we can't remember the Armenian genocide because that would take away from the Holocaust. And, you know, look, I mean, the way I see it, even if the narrative was 100% correct, as it's taught to us in public school, then the Jews still do not have a monopoly on suffering in human history. That, you know, whether it was the Irish who were taken and occupied, had their language stolen from them, were killed and raped, you know, and they suffered through. If you want to talk about the Tibetans that are facing genocide right now, I mean, if you want to talk about, you know, the Armenians, all these different ethnic communities, every group of people has enslaved other groups of people. Every group of people has fought other groups of people, and every group of people has had atrocities committed against them. The Jews do not have a monopoly on suffering, but they need to have a monopoly on suffering in the public consciousness when it comes to movies that are coming out, when it comes to bills that are being passed that they read to kids, you know, in their elementary schools and things like that, to remember the Holocaust, to be able to control the curriculum. They need to control this dialogue on suffering to then justify their current exploitation of fellow Semites. You know, the media calls us anti-Semites, but the Jews are exploiting fellow Semites in the Middle East and bombing them and blowing up their schools and their hospitals and taking away sovereignty from a people, literally committing genocide against the Palestinians. But they need to be able to try and keep the moral high ground of perpetual suffering to justify that. And then, of course, to be able to justify, you know, there was that German Jewish politician who actually said, you know, come out and fight the Nazis, and more Germans die than are born. And that's a good thing. It says the Nazis aren't having babies, and basically cheering the demographic destruction. And it's put into this narrative that Germany and, you know, basically all of Europe needs to die in repayment of a blood debt because of the Holocaust. So they need to be able to keep this media narrative up. They need to be able to keep this monopoly on suffering. And it really goes to show kind of a totem pole of an ethnic pecking order within the left, that, you know, indigenous peoples, you know, who, you know, Justin Trudeau from Canada has been apologizing to every ethnic community he can get his hands on. But, you know, so they've got, you know, every ethnic community has got different gripes about different things. But, you know, when you go head to head with the Holocaust, the Jews will make that win every time. Like, you know, it's like slavery. Ah, well, that was, you know, that'll be number two, you know, like the indigenous people of Australia, the Aboriginals, like, that'll be number three. You know, there's a pecking order where the Jews always put themselves on top, that they'll use other ethnic groups to attack whites, but they will always remain the perpetual victims on top, because they need it geopolitically, you know, both in the Middle East, but also here in our home countries.
Well, yeah, they have to be the number one victim. And it's interesting that you brought up the treatment of the Irish and the Armenians, because a lot of these atrocities that were committed against these other races, the Jews have had a hand in it. And the Jews were running the crown, the City of London, which is the banking system. And it was through the banking system that the starvation of the Irish was caused. The Jews were involved with the Young Turks that massacred the Armenians. Of course, we know the Holodomor was carried out by the Jews working for Stalin and the Bolsheviks that were taking away all the seed, and the Jews were parts of the NKVD. I mean, going right back 2,000 years to the Roman times, you have these revolutionary Jews that are involved in massacres of other races. And this goes all the way back. And yet here they are claiming that they were the victims of this terrible atrocity, this gassing of 6 squillion Jews, and for which there is no evidence for it whatsoever. And they know that the evidence is lacking. That's why they have to take the control of the media. That's why they have to hammer it home to people. That's why they have to ensure that it's taught in schools, because they know that the evidence for it is so flimsy. And it's all so that they can cover up their attacks against us, because they really have a dislike of white people, because we're everything they're not. We're everything that they are not capable of being. That you might get the odd attractive looking Jewess, but they're not an attractive looking type of people to look at. And they just look at white people, and they know that there's a difference there. They know that there's a difference there with our creativity and with our culture and with our history, and they really don't have any. They talk about Nobel Prizes, but that's them giving prizes to themselves, not white people.
Well, you know, and it's an interesting thing. If you even look at the media narrative, where, I mean, look, especially as Hollywood's become more and more Jewish, the narrative of it's always the weak nerd or the dorky girl, and who is the bad guy every single time. In all the classic 80s movies till today, the bad guy is always a big, strong, heterosexual white male who plays football, boxes, or, whatever he does. That there's always this physically weaker protagonist that's just being bullied for no reason, like this giant German or Anglo-Saxon 18-year-old senior just woke up that morning and was like, I'm gonna just really be mean to this this gay kid or this the theater nerd or something like that, and then always using their ingenuity this weaker character is able to overcome the physically stronger, physically more attractive, socially dominant, white male. And I truly think that that's actually kind of a revealing look into the psyche of Jews, because of course they make the majority of writing and directing positions. And if you look, it's almost like they know and they idealize the fact that we are physically stronger and at any point in time could beat us, but they think they can creatively sneak around and use their brains. Usually the nerds have a multicultural friend group, to be able to use their multicultural positions to be able to, eventually bully back and defeat the strong white male, the football team or whatever it is. And I think that's actually a revealing look within the Jewish psyche of how they view us and how they view themselves, that they're smarter than us and can outsmart us, but they know they can't physically beat us, and they're gonna do whatever they can to subvert us. And I think that's a good look into what they actually think, because if it was just one movie or two movies, I would, just call it a coincidence. But that seems to be a trend to me that goes through Hollywood productions of how white heterosexual males are presented and how they're presented.
Well, I think they're constantly trying to weaken us. I mean, this is their dysgenic program that they promote with equality. By promoting equality, it's basically a dysgenic program. It's saying that we should put the least capable in the most important positions without them having the qualifications to be there. It's saying that we should be rewarding the people that are the least capable with welfare, which is why you get more people without jobs producing children than you do get people with a high IQ producing children. And this goes back to the eugenics program that the German state had, the National Socialist German state. They were interested in improving the hygiene of the race. And this wasn't by killing lots of undesirables. What this was done, how this was done, but was by encouraging those who had defective genes, was encouraging them to become sterilized. And if they did become sterilized, they would give them children to adopt, and they would give them a higher position, a higher social position, so they could climb the societal ladder, and they could climb up, as it were, almost through the classes, through becoming sterilized and showing that they were doing their bit for the nation. They didn't want to produce defective children. They didn't want alcoholic children, blind children, children with limbs missing, mental defects. They didn't want that. Whereas today, we encourage that. We give them lots of money. We'll even give them IVF if they want to breed. They're even putting up Down syndrome girls as models and putting them up as a model to aspire to and trying to get people to feel sexy about Down syndrome models, which is really, really sick and twisted. But that's...
That example right there, when they've got the mental capacity of like a five-year-old, if you just want to understand the insanity of the modern age, it's sexualizing a mental child. I don't care their physical age. And I believe we should care for them. You know, it's not their fault. But the idea of sexualizing someone who has the mental age of a child, if that doesn't show you, and putting her in a bikini and putting those pictures out and telling her she needs to get in touch with her sexuality, if that doesn't tell you there's something wrong with the modern age, I don't know what does.
Well, yeah, it's really sick. I mean, I said for a while we'll end up with a Down syndrome prime minister, and then we ended up with Down syndrome models. I mean, that's where it's all going. And when we get told about the euthanasia and this killing people off, I mean, what they had is if there were people that were in extreme pain, that whose quality of life was below the lowest standard that you can think of, then if their family wished for them not to suffer anymore, and two doctors signed a thing to say that they agreed that the person was living this horrific life of suffering, then they could have euthanasia, but only then. It wasn't something that was forced on people. It wasn't something that was done to the Jews. It was something that was done to people that really had no quality of life otherwise, and whose carers that were caring for them who were signing the consent if they were unable to sign the consent for themselves. So they were interested in improving the quality of the nation and improving the quality of the people. Now, some people might say, well, that's anti-Christian. All life is sacred, but man was created in the image of God. So if you have a man that is deformed, grotesquely deformed and mentally deficient, that is a mockery of the image of God. God doesn't want people to exist like that. He wants people to be in the image of him, perfect. So what they were doing was encouraging more of people in the image of God rather than in the image of a mockery of God. So I don't see it as being anti-Christian to do that. I think it was a positive thing that they do. It was all a part of this package that they had, which was basically about doing what's best for the nation and making the individual's needs subservient to the nation. Again, as I said at the end of the last program, it's real love for your neighbor.
Right. And you know, and that's where there's a big difference between, you know, as I refer to, you know, soft eugenics versus hard eugenics. That the media narrative is one where the Germans were doing hard eugenics of just like kicking pregnant women that had, you know, a genetic problem like down the stairs, like absolutely insane over the top things. And no, I agree with you. Cause I mean, I truly believe that all life is sacred. And, you know, if a baby has Down syndrome, I believe it should be taken to term. But, you know, what we need to be able to do is prevent the lives from happening in the first place, not through abortion or things like that, but by having a positive eugenics program to, like you said, you know, the National Socialists did with sterilization willingly. If parents are willing to take, you know, if we were to go into a community and there was someone that had a disease where there was a 55% chance their kid was going to have this terrible debilitating disorder, say, look, you know, for $100,000, $200,000, you know, something like that, to be sterilized, you know, because of the medical costs, because they won't be able to pay for it if they're poor, that's going to be put on the state. It's cheaper for the state and it's better for the race in the long term to be able to do these things. And it's the idea of a soft eugenics, to give financial incentives for the best and the brightest and the healthiest to be able to have more kids. It's not just about not having kids in the population. It's about having the right people having the right amount of kids and encouraging them and providing for families. And that's, you know, what the Germans did through a whole host of different programs and social initiatives. So no, I mean, I totally think there's nothing wrong, especially in a Christian perspective. You know, I don't believe in abortion for, you know, the purpose, especially in things like Down syndrome, where they're not going to breed in the first place, most likely. But if we can willingly have a positive soft eugenics program where the best of the best is having the most kids, and then, you know, we have that sterilization option, we have these different options on the table to improve the gene pool as best as possible, because it's, you know, when you think about morality, is it moral to birth a child to be crippled? Is it moral to knowingly birth a child to be retarded or, you know, lose a limb or something like that. So we need to be able to improve the race. We need to be able to improve our community and our culture. And that's what the Germans did. And that's what we need to be able to have a policy on. So, looks like we've come to the end of our show, Sven. So for all of my dear listeners, I just, you know, Sven, want to thank you for joining me today. And this is a big topic that we could probably talk about for months, and by golly, we just might. But I'm going to be back tomorrow with John Friend as my co-host to talk about some new exciting adventures that he's been having. And then we'll be able to close out the week. So thank you guys so much for listening today. Thank you, Sven, for joining me. And I'll look forward to seeing you guys tomorrow. Hail Vic.
You've been tuned into The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heimbach at Radio Area. .com